Podcast. I'm Max.
I'm Rich.
And on this podcast, we will be focusing on the mystery and madness of the Weird War Tales comic book series published by DC Comics from 1971 to 1983. On this episode in particular, we're taking a look at Weird War Tales number 52. But first, Rich has some retroactive history for you.
Probably should have seen this one coming if you were paying attention last time. Back in Sergeant Rock 349, Max asked the question of our fan base to confirm Jack Kirby had been involved in the plan to spring the hostages being held in Tehran. Incredibly, Max was right! And Tim DeForest found the evidence to prove it. When CIA officer Tony Mendez was working up a cover story to rescue six Americans held in Iran, he wanted to disguise them as a Hollywood film crew scouting locations in Tehran as part of an elaborate ruse to sneak them out of the country. They needed a screenplay and cover art to fool the authorities, however. Luckily, writer and inventor Barry Ira Geller was trying to adapt the sci-fi novel Lord of Light into a movie about colonists from another planet. Geller also wanted to build a sci-fi theme park, so he called up Marvel Comics Jack Kirby, legendary artist, writer, and co-creator of Captain America. Together, they created 13 architectural drawings of the theme park's key structures before the project's financing fell apart. The movie was never made, the theme park was put on hold, and the script and artwork were shelved. Behind the scenes, however, Geller's Hollywood makeup artist, John Chambers, best known for Planet of the Apes, was working undercover for the CIA. He was the agency's Mission Impossible guy, who could turn black men into white men, Geller said. Chambers slipped Tony Mendez the script and Kirby's sketches in 1979. The CIA was soon incorporating the Lord of Light screenplay and artwork into a daring agency rescue operation named Argo, part of a larger-than-life operation that would be used to save the lives of American hostages sheltering with the Canadian diplomats in Iran. As we all know, the mission was later turned into Ben Affleck's Oscar-winning spy thriller Argo in 2012. Geller told Comic-Con in 2017 that he was interviewed by a group called Sons of the Revolutionaries of Iran, who confirmed it was Kirby's drawings, in particular Terminal of the Gods, that really sold the movie cover story to the government. After the Shah relinquished power, they saw the drawings of larger-than-life gods as representative of the return of their national religion. It was the perfect script and drawing for Iran's locations in their desert, with bazaars, temples, etc., Geller said. Without Geller's Lord of Light script and Jack Kirby's drawings, there would not have been Argo at all. So, thanks to Max and Tim for that double team. If I ever knew that, I have long since forgotten it. Intel report. Where monsters dwell, the phantom eagle flies the savage skies. A five-issue mini by Marvel Comics published between July and December of 2015. Script by Garth Ennis. Art by Russ Braun. Fighter planes and dinosaurs collide in this raucous tale that starts with the classic Marvel character Phantom Eagle. Ace pilot Carl Kaufman investigates the Valley of Flames, but soon finds himself in way over his head. Between hungry dinosaurs and angry Amazonians, Carl has never been in a tighter spot. Garth Ennis does The War the Time Forgot, people. I asked Garth at Terrificon a couple of years ago if he'd ever do a World War I story, and he said probably not. And this story is as close as he's come, so go pick it up. Or, you know, we could do it for you. I'm looking at the calendar and realize it's that time of year, dear listeners. Let the fan voting for previous Intel reports commence to select an upcoming special mission. There have been too many to list on a poll, unfortunately, so you'll have to go to the Intel Report album on the FB page, which I will share to our feed to make it easier to find. Obviously, Haunted Tank is out of the running as the winner of the first fan vote. Message the show with your selection, and we will announce the winner on the first episode of the show in May. Vote early, vote often. Getting to the comic in question. Cover detail, art by Joe Kubert. 30 cents. An American and a German soldier face each other and grapple in a brutal hand-to-hand contest, their uniforms in shreds. Both have red hair and could pass as brothers. A massive white skull of death grins behind them on a black background, and the red Weird War Tales title tops it off. Cover date, April 1977. Date of release, January 6th, 1977. Killjoy, Nazi armband in the field.
Doo-dah.
Nazi armband in the field.
Oh, doo-dah day. So, comments and commendations on this cover. I'll kick it off and say it's an eye-catching cover from Joe Kubert with a dramatic conflict framed by a looming skull of death. Welcome to the Weird War Troops. It's a simple cover, but effective. And it even ties directly into the specific content of this issue. But I'll let Rich touch more on that point.
Another pretty solid effort by the late, great J.K. If you look at the cover, you can see the two combatants not only look alike, but are fighting alike as well. The hand of each one closest to the viewer has gotten a hold of the other's uniform and is tearing it off, exposing their backs. The skull watching the show is a great touch, too. You get a definite vibe someone isn't walking away from this one. So I shall lead off the show because I've been talking a lot, and I'll just keep on talking. Story number one, The Devil is a Souvenir Hunter. 6 pages, script by Robert Conniger, art by Frank Redondo. It's the cover story. Under a burning desert sun, Hack Thomas's unit springs a deadly ambush on a German patrol. In Thomas's mind, his blazing slugs rip at the memory of a childhood spent in an orphanage. Anonymous, unwanted, abused. He fights without mercy, and the Germans are quickly eliminated. He wastes no time scurrying into the open to give the dead Germans another burst from his carbine, just to be sure. Checking the bodies, Thomas is pleased to find an iron cross as a souvenir. But he also decides to leave a remembrance of his own when he booby traps the enemy dead with a hand grenade. Other soldiers don't approve as Thomas hurries back to his foxhole with a grin on his face, thinking he's a grave robber. Under a full desert moon that evening, Thomas silently watches as a lone German soldier checks the bodies for signs of life. An explosion lights up the night. Surprise! Thomas yells as he runs out to look for more souvenirs, and again the others look on with disgust. He ain't human, one of them mutters. Human? Maybe not. For surely something else beyond mortal ken is at work this night. Because the fresh casualty has the same face as Thomas. Impossible. Must be the light of the moon playing tricks. Don't lose any sleep over it. The next day, Thomas's unit is relieved and they head back to base. Leading the way, Thomas discovers a German scout in their path. Without hesitation, the American pulls out his knife. He smiles as he rams it into the sentry's back, who cries out, "Gott in Himmel!" as he dies. Patting down his latest kill for prizes, he's again surprised to see the German is wearing his face. Again, Thomas discards the coincidence. Everyone has a double somewhere in the world. Thomas had just killed his. Pulling out the German's wallet, Thomas finds a snapshot of the dead Kraut and his girl. The girl just looks just like Tina, Thomas's ex. The dizzy dame had dove over a roof because he'd given her the heave-ho. He thinks nothing of it as the rest of the unit comes up and he leads them back. They arrive just in time to help repel an enemy attack. To his amazement, every single enemy soldier he aims at looks just like him, and each round he fires feels like it's ripping through his guts, and he screams in agony. The sergeant runs up and Thomas starts babbling. The Kraut I killed! He looks exactly like me! Sarge glances at the German lying in front of Thomas's position. You got loco? This guy doesn't look like you. Take another look and see for yourself. But Thomas only sees himself in the dead man and runs off. The sergeant runs after him. He's a Section 8 for sure. Under a scorching desert sun, the souvenir hunter flees in an attempt to escape the searing flame in his brain. He dives onto a lone German soldier. No one's going to kick me around again. I'm going to kill every one of you jokers I see until there's no one left but me. Two weapons fire, and two men lie dead in their desert. And this time, the dead German really does have Thomas's face. War is a graveyard, and in the end, the only souvenir hunter is the devil.
No Killjoy. Comments and commendations. And here I am again, and I will say right away, I liked the host drawing, unlike some people. It has kind of like a bleached out, like washed out by the sun sort of soft focus quality to it. It's just a cool drawing, in my opinion. And his opening line is nice and brutal as well. It's, you know, Rich pretty much read it, but the desert battlefield is a graveyard filled with screams and silence eternal, where fear beats at a man's brain as brutally as the vicious sun. I am death, yet it was there that I learned the devil is a souvenir hunter. I love it. So right off to a good start for me, right? It's not exactly all downhill from there, in my opinion, but there aren't really that many high points after that either for me. I mean, I have a list of essentially complaints. First of all, Hack Thomas, why? Is this some shot at Roy Thomas? Was Hack ever a common nickname? It just pulled me out. And I felt the revulsion that was felt by old Hack's fellow troops was a bit over the top. This is war, and those are dead Nazis. Keeping souvenirs is a bit off, for sure, but he ain't making a necklace of severed ears here, okay? And while Redondo's art is more than just competent throughout, he fails to really sell the main storytelling point on page 3, panel 2. It's me! Is it, though? You kind of have to take Hack's word for it that German looks like him. I know later it's revealed he's seeing things, but it would be nice if we at first saw those things with him, and that panel ain't doing it. Kubert did a much better job and with fewer lines of conveying the sameness of appearance on this issue's cover than Redondo ever manages to do in the actual story. On page 4, I just had to assume what Hack meant by his girl having dove over a roof in panel 2. If that was a common, you know, euphemism for committing suicide or jumping off it's long since fallen out of use. So that sort of pulled me out too. And the link to calling Hack the devil in panel 4 is so clunky, you can hear the gears grinding against each other. At least on page 5, I was reminded of the Corsican brothers, Cheech and Chong, when Hack feels the pain of the enemy he's shooting. So that was a high point for me. And on page 6, the payoff is just not there. The detail of Hack's past as being kicked around or whatever is just too flimsy to matter. And the it's me theme ends up feeling pretty empty, I feel. To me, this just felt like the first draft of a story that needed considerable fleshing out and editing before seeing print.
As Max hinted, this one got off with a bit of a bump with a goofy looking death on page 1 narration duty. The helmet low over his eyes and a couple of missing teeth give him a happy to be here, son, grin. But as I've said a few times already, Redondo was the Sergeant Rock artist I grew up on. So it gets back on track pretty quickly, and Conniger no doubt wrote most of those tales. Thomas had a rough life as a kid, and he took it out on the enemy when he grew up. You don't have to like it, but booby-trapping the dead, page 2, panels 5 and 6, and shooting them again to make sure, page 2, panel 2, was done. War is hell, after all. At least he wasn't prying out gold teeth, or as Max said, cutting off ears. But, the Comics Code Authority may have had something to say about that. Any dregs of sympathy you may have had for Thomas took off when he mocks his old girlfriend for killing herself after he broke up with her, page 4, panel 2. That may have been the darkest panel in the story, but I do have to agree with Max on how one never really sees the similarities in Thomas and all the dead Germans. Still, all in all, pretty good stuff and a great start to the book.
Alrighty, there we go. That's the opener. We're going to move on to the middle story of the book, people, and this is the conclusion of a continued saga, a two-parter, begun last issue, based on the world of Commandy, the Last Boy on Earth, by Jack Kirby. This is a Canterbury tale, spelled T-A-I-L. It's Tales of the Great Disaster Part 2, Calamity on the Clyde. It's 6 pages long. We got a plot by Paul Levitz. Script by Jack C. Harris, pencils by Marshall Rogers, and inks by Terry Austin. So there's a pretty good murderer's row of talent, just like last time. Let's see how it works out. Synopsis goes like this. Just like year 700 after the bomb, we're not reviewing what happened to get John B. Temple Smythe, mayor of Canterbury and a literal bulldog of a man, hanging on by his nails to a huge fire-spewing insect as it flies northwards towards Glasgow. Remember. Scratching for a handhold to keep from falling to his death, Temple Smythe grabs the giant bug's antennae. He instantly hears voices in his head and knows they belong to the Scotch terrorist MacDougall. The flying devil was somehow being controlled by the Scot, who's a little literal Scottish terrier human looking thing. Listen to the last episode, like we said. As he had already suspected, many kilometers to the north, the interference that Temple Smythe creates when he grabs the antenna causes MacDougall to grab his head and howl in agony. The others crowd around him and say,
"Something must be attacking the devil. He's got to break through Intermind."
Intermind. MacDougall had learned of his mystic ability to control the terrifying insects as a pup, and he used that ability to bring the Scottish terrorist to power by using the fearsome bug in horrifying demonstrations of his superiority over the innocent by destroying their homes. But a single devil wasn't enough for the ambitious MacDougall. There was a nest of devil eggs in Canterbury country, but there was a unit of elite guards quartered nearby. Too many for even his devil to chase off. The fools didn't even know what the eggs were. The dominion of the devils was too far away. This was the only place he could gain access to more devils. And here's where we do the podcast equivalent of an editor's note. Page 3, panel 2 says, see map and commandy 32 for the domain of the devils. Or you can just trust your host to do it for you and check out the album for this episode. Spoiler, it's Canada. The issue itself, Commandy number 32, is a 68-page Jack Kirby fest from August 1975, and I'll have more to say about that in my comments and commendations. So, as MacDougall regains his senses from the telepathic feedback, Temple Smythe absorbs the information he had learned, filtered through the Intermind, and formulates a daring plan. MacDougall knew Temple Smythe was responsible for the feedback. Goes two ways, you know. And that the Canterbury mayor knew the truth by reading his thoughts via that Intermind connection. As MacDougall wondered what Temple Smythe's next move was, the gallant mayor overflew the nest of devil eggs. At the precise moment, Temple Smythe tightly squeezes the insect's antennae again, sending another wave of agony tearing through MacDougall's mind. The Scot immediately retaliates.
Fire! Burn the crummy devil!
Flames explode from the devil's tail, just as Temple Smythe had banked on. Grasping the antennae even tighter, the mayor savagely wrenches them out of the insect's head. Unparalleled anguish leaps the 620 kilometers between Canterbury and Glasgow and wipes MacDougall's brain clean. The other Scots lament the loss of their leader.
We've lost me brothers. None of us can control devils.
Over the nesting area near Canterbury, the dying devil spirals down, trailing flame behind it. As Temple Smythe jumps clear, the insect crashes into the nest of eggs, destroying them all. But the sweet taste of victory is mixed with that of bitter defeat. Canterbury is aflame. He runs back to help and is greeted back by his subjects, who are happy to see him safe. Even better, the fires are out. And all of the citizens are alive and ready to rebuild. Placing a foot on a cobbled pedestal, Temple Smythe speaks to the weary in front of the smoldering ruins. Canterbury was raised from the ashes of the great disaster. We can't allow a lesser disaster to bring us down. Those who sought our destruction are gone, defeated. And we are the victors. We are strong. We are of what the ancients called the gem, the jewel in the ocean. We are of England, and we shall endure. Oh, Killjoy, so here comes Rich.
We said hello to Harris and Austin last issue, and now we say farewell. We do not see them again in these pages. Just a quick little TDY assignment. Just like last time, panel designs for this tale were very creatively rendered. Page 2, panel 3, Temple Smythe grabbing the insect's antenna forms two sides of the panel border. The same effect is rendered on page 4, panel 3, capturing MacDougall's pain even better than the first time. The silhouette of the devil on panel 5 makes me wonder if the insect wasn't some sort of giant lightning bug, which would make all the sense in the world, if you think about it. Comic companies had crazy ways of portraying plaids in this time period. Look at the perfect and totally unrealistic symmetry on page 5, panel 1. Final grade for our second consecutive multi-part day after Doomsday Tale is 2 thumbs up. And again, I initially dreaded doing it when I saw it coming. Are there more commandy backup stories coming? I don't know. But this one fit in the book just fine.
Yeah, I agree. Even as a rabid Kirby fan, get it, rabid story about dogs. I had my trepidations about this being squeezed into Weird War Tales too. I wasn't really thinking this would fit. So my official kickoff to my CNC, I'm going to say, you know, I'm inclined to love this stuff, as everyone knows. But man, the effort spent to incorporate this story into this issue of the actual Weird War Tales series couldn't be used to crush a ripe grape, I gotta say. There's no host, just like last time. A pretty anemic little text bar for even the original backup series title is there. There's just a little there. Also on page 1, the part 2 spotlight circle, if you can call it that, is way too small to be of much use. Now, before you think I have nothing but gripes about this story or this issue in general, those are my biggest complaints about this part. I mean, right away, we are reminded of our writing team's attunement to the Jack Kirby vibe, and maybe more than a little Stan Lee, too, with lines like, the fearsome flying fiend of our far-flung future. So it seems like we're in pretty good hands here once we get into the story content. On page 2, panel 5, we get another great example of the intermind effect, the narration more so than the drawing, but still. And then the very next panel, I really dig a flashback frame that's in use there. It's also in that panel where my mind finally saw the pun being used for the name of the Scottish Terrierists, for which delay I am deeply ashamed. Page 3, panel 2, features that editor's note that we mentioned, directing us to the Earth AD map and Commandy number 32. But the Domain of the Devils was also visible in the more limited scope of the Commandy's continent map, featured in Commandy number 1. Granted, that issue would have been harder to get one's hands on at the time, and that earlier map didn't feature the Mad Hole Country of the Screamers either, so I'll let it slide. Between pages 4 and 5, we are treated to 4 pages of ads, one of which I did pick for my spotlight choice, so okay, fine. But when we finally arrive on page 5, panel 1, at least we're treated to the gruesome scene and awesome dialogue of MacDougall and his brain! He's blown his brain out of his head! Wrapping it all up on page 6, I found the mostly off-screen resolution of the citywide fire to be a bit quick, although it does give us space for that really nice final panel of the British Bulldogs vowing to endure. My final nitpick, though, is that I do still think that this is all a bit too tied to the pre-disaster past for a Commandy story. How do these dogs know what the ancients called their land, and so on? But even I have to admit that I would love to read about 100 more of these Tales of the Great Disaster stories. So, still overall very pleased, but I'm still me. I had to pick some nits. In a deal that we struck before we started recording, I'm also going to take us into the third and final story in this issue, for reasons that will become clear. It's called The Hordes of Hell. It's 5 pages long. Script is by veteran writer of the series, Jack Olick, and first timer on art duties, Tenny Henson. So synopsis for The Hordes of Hell kicks off with Gorta and his band of warriors hack and slash their way through another wave of attacking Centurions. It is Centurions in my copy, not Centurions. Even though you want to say Centurions, it is an R in mine, and I made sure of it. So attacking Centurions, it doesn't make sense. No matter how many Centurions fall, others continue to arrive. How can a land so tiny possess such hordes? Unless the tales are true, and their high priest has some magic that breeds warriors. Once we've found that priest, we'll know the truth, Gorta exclaims. Of all the lands that lie upon our borders, this one alone pays me no tribute, but pay they will. Unless we perish first, Morin, one of Gorta's commanders, replies. Not one of all the warriors you have sent to seek that tribute has returned alive from this accursed land. Indeed, of all the host, that had followed Gortan to the Certurian Hills, only a poor handful remained. In battle after battle, death had reaped its toll. But this time, Gorta, the chief, led the way. Perhaps this land is what they say, a killing ground. But even if I die, I mean to learn the secret of its strength. So, forward, and death to the Certurians! Gorta leads the charge and collides into the next wave of onrushing Certurians, his deadly blade cutting down his foes like ripened wheat. When the fray is over, Gorta is again victorious, but each victory thins his ranks more. Morin counsels Gorta to turn back, but Gorta will not hear of it. No! I'll tear that secret from their hearts with my bare hands if I must. One day further on, we'll find their city and their high priest. Turn back or follow as you choose, but I go on. Shamed, then, are the warriors who, till this day, have known no fear. They tremble, as men have always trembled before the unknown, but still they follow. Again and still again, they fight against an army that cannot be, struggling on and leaving their dead behind until a walled city appears before them. Gorta attacks, ignoring Morin's plea to come back. There is no way a force as small as theirs can storm these walls. The chief is mad, but still his men blindly follow him into battle. What magic breeds these Certurians like flies? If Gorta dies, he'll at least die like a man, and so will they. A volley of arrows from the castle destroys Gorta's band. Only the chief reaches the castle, and he is surprised to see the gates open to welcome him. No one is to be seen inside, and Gorta flings his challenge into the air. Certurian swine, why do you hesitate? Do all of you then fear a single warrior? Just then the high priest steps from the shadows and leans on his sword. They fear no power on earth, man from the outside world, but I am he whom you have come so far to find. Well, I know why you have come, and others have come before you, to kill me, and so end the magic that makes our land invincible. Kill me then, if you can. Steel clashes on steel as the two men struggle, slashing and hacking. But even in his madness, Gorta soon realizes that he has met his match at last. One final slash and it is done. But one regret has Gorta, that he has not learned what he came to learn. Then death's cold finger touches him. He does not know when the priest takes his limp form into a deep embrace, but then Gorta rises. All memory of what has gone before has been wiped from his mind. Proud Gorta knows now how the Certurians came to be. If he were able to recall the past, he would truly go mad. His fatal wound is gone, but in its place are two smaller wounds on his throat. The high priest embraces Gorta and smiles. You were a fool to try to cut us down. What use to slaughter men who will but rise again? But that no longer matters now. For from this day you will be one of us. Welcome, brother. The Certurians are all vampires. Killjoy, I'll chime in on this one. Welcome back, daywalking vampires. We've missed ya. It's been too long. And I'll kick off the CNC as well, because this is firmly in my wheelhouse here. Now, as far as vampiric resurrection giving people amnesia in the story, is that part of the legend and lore out there? Not usually, not commonly, certainly, but I'll give it some wiggle room, as being reborn could leave one as a blank slate, and it could be up to the master whether you recall your previous life or not. I mean, Dracula's brides, even in the original Dracula, seem to be borderline mindless. They don't seem to remember a human past. And even as the one woman is changing in that story, she seems to be losing touch with her humanity. So there's room there. So either I can let it slide or accept it as a cool new extension of the overall vampire myth, as opposed to daywalking vampires, which should probably be restrained to just Dracula himself and Bram Stoker's novel, or to Blade and those first well, the first two Kick-Ass Blade movies, let's say. So getting on with the rest of my CNC. Right away, this story is buttering me up with an excellent and innovative splash page, in my opinion, from the drippingly bloody and nicely written intro text to the flowing cloak of the creepy-looking host, and the completely borderless panels of the page design itself. The opening of this tale had it right where it wanted me. I will note here, though, that the animal pelt on Gorta's head is just distractingly cute. Who could ever want to harm a single hair on that thing? It's the Gorta Gopher! Snarf, snarf! Page 2 shows off more masterful design work, flowing from a close-up to an establishing shot to a panorama over to a long-distance silhouette panel before winding it all back up with another close-up. It all keeps things very visually interesting without causing a single hiccup for the storytelling. Over on page 3, panel 5, are we bearing witness to the fall of He Santa, the Xmas Barbarian? Or is that old man Travis Morgan? Hard to tell. We don't have time for that now. Page 4 gives us a rather short fight after all that buildup. And yes, folks, page 5 gives us the return of day-walking vampires to the pages of Weird War Tales. And these vamps can even apparently be killed by regular weapons in combat, as Gorda's people have been doing that all along this journey to the enemy's stronghold. Maybe they are weaker in daylight, like Bram Stoker's Dracula was, instead of just bursting into fiery piles of soot. Who knows? At this point, I'm kind of glad to see this bewildering trope rise from its grave to haunt these pages once more. In my opinion, this story was fun stuff.
Ah, the classic tale of a commander wiping out his command due to having a one-track mind. You knew how this was going to pan out by the halfway point, although the big vampire reveal at the end was a bit of a surprise for yours truly, at least. Olek does Olek. But Henson's art reminds me of a cross between Jodleman and Duran Nona, leaning more towards Duran Nona, unfortunately, so I didn't care for it too much. So many of the panel backgrounds were solid pink or orange, too, which didn't help. Our eerie narrator is well done, but it looks like he's wearing a friggin' pink cloak. Really? Hard no. It's too bad because it's a nice opening panel otherwise, down to the title having a femur and skull for an exclamation point. Liked page 3, panel 5 of the salvo of arrows mowing down the column of attackers, and page 4, panel 1 of the silhouette of Gorta standing alone in the open gate of the Saturians. But page 4, panel 5, the high priest so holding his sword overhead to finish Gorta off looks statuesque. What do you think for 5 Fredlight? Overall, giving this a thumbs down.
And, ooh, hang on.
Like I said, people didn't come here for us to agree all the time. Come on. Boring. So, onward to the APO Weird War Tales letters page. And according to the script that I wrote, I go first. So, hey, we're going to hear from David Burson from Strong, Arkansas. There's Strong, Arkansas. Who? Dear Joe, Weird War Tales number 48 was nothing to complain about, especially art-wise. B. Grinnell and Bill Drought have always been two of my favorites, so I was very happy to see them in this issue. And speaking of art, whatever happened to Alex Nino? I've missed him in the pages of Weird War. The stories in this issue were nothing to sneeze at either. Even though the idea from Ultimate Destiny has been used before, you pulled it off very nicely this time. The three-pager by Cashdan and Drought was good, too. As far as the Day After Doomsday feature goes, I think you should definitely continue it regularly. Agreed. For the most part, they are all very enjoyable. I must disagree with many of the people who have been writing in and asking to drop the one-page introductions. I think they give Weird War a special, unique quality. Keep it up. Again, agreed. David Burson, Strong, Arkansas, and Joe responds. As you can plainly see, both the Day After Doomsday and the one-page introductions have been continued in this issue. Pause. Actually, no, they are not. There is no one-page introduction in this issue. As we've stated before, this Day After Doomsday was originally slated for Kamandi, but was put in WWT after it was decided to give the last boy on Earth full-length stories. If reaction is good, you'll see many, many more of these tales, or judging from this issue's story, tales, T-A-I-L-S, yuck, 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 in future issues. So
I have not looked that far ahead yet. I do not know if Commandi Commandi back stories appear in this book again, but hey, looking forward to finding out. Max.
Hey, nice Killjoy on the editorial reply, by the way. No one is safe, people. Killjoy can strike anywhere at any time. So for my spotlighted letter here, it starts out like so. Dear Joe, I just finished reading the 49th issue of Weird War Tales, and I like it. I really dig the sparkling Coletta cover, as well as the insides. Each story shows that war is really crazy. I'm glad to see that Steve Ditko is still drawing. He keeps drawing for a while yet, buddy. He's one of the all-time greats of comic books, and it would be a shame if he stopped. The last story of the issue was really something else, as it showed the true nightmare of war and what it could lead people to do. Hey, what about some stories about the France-Russian War of the 1870s or the American Civil War? I'm getting a little tired of seeing stories from World War II. And that letter comes from Charles Haskell of, as David and Peter from the Earth 2 podcast would say, New York, New York. Joe Orlando's response to Charlie is as follows. Our writers come up with stories concerning whatever time period or war they consider fits best. When they come up with stories about the wars you mention, or any others, we'll be sure to bring them to you. And while we're usually too modest to plug ourselves more than once in a letter column, sure you are, we can't help but let you know about a surprise that Steve Ditko is currently cooking up. While it's too early to give details, we can tell you that it's a book created by Steve, and it's sure to startle and amaze you. Yes, folks, as we've mentioned before, this takes place not only, you know, sort of during Jack Kirby's move to DC to create the Fourth World and Commandy and the Demon and all these other awesome books, but also during Steve Ditko's defection from Marvel or from Charlton, but, you know, having left Marvel to come over to DC to launch some books that were all failures. But created characters that lasted much longer than the series themselves. It was a heck of a time for people, I imagine, reading these books brand new, which I was still a little too young to be doing. But to see the stalwarts of Marvel, like Kirby and Ditko, no small pillars to that building of Marvel Comics, all of a sudden making new stuff for DC, must have been cool to see it happening in real time. So I had to pick that one. That closes the Weird War Tales, APO Weird War Tales office, or whatever the hell I'm supposed to say. And now we're going to move on to our spotlighted ads for the issue. And I'm going to kick it off with, like I said, this is one of those ads that was part of the way too many ads in the middle of that one story in the issue, in the middle of Canterbury Tales, but it's a good one. It's a full page ad saying, "Big Blockbuster presenting the next two DC Dollar Comics." And yes, the first one sounds cool enough. It's World's Finest. It's got Superman, Batman, you know, in the 3 million targets, Black Canary and Rainbows of Doom, Green Arrow and Slings and Arrows. Okay. Yeah. The Vigilante and Explosion in a Small Town and Wonder Woman in Jeopardy times two. And it says no reprints, all new stories, which, you know, 80 page giants and some of these 100 page books, they had tons of reprints in them, which was cool at the time because they were reprints of books you probably couldn't get your hands on, like Golden Age stuff. But these were all new stories, including the reason I picked this ad. It's a dollar comic featuring G.I. Combat. It has two haunted tank stories. The Rocking Chair Soldiers and What's the Price of a GI, two OSS thrillers, The Human Flare, and The Hawk Who Saved D-Day, plus Open the Grave and Fire, a weird war story, The Sniper and Skirts, The Three-in-One Soldier, The Preacher is a Gun, it's a haunted tank solo story starring Gus, and more all-new combat features. On sale January 13th that year. Can you imagine a better collection of just titles for stories? The cover looks awesome too, even in the small thumbprint size it's depicted in the ad. I know Rich has got this issue. He's got all the GI Combats, right? So I'm reading this one off you, man, just to see if the story titles are backed up by the content, because that just the story titles alone are so kick-ass. And I got one more thing to add here before I let Rich jump in. about GI combat. Over on the Comics World section of the Daily Planet insert, they mention Lola Barnett. Now, I just thought that was cool because Lola Barnett was a gossip columnist for the Daily Planet and also had a gossip show on WGBS-TV, which directly followed Clark Kent's evening news broadcast. She later left WGBS and came to work for its rival, United Broadcasting Company. Her first appearance and last appearance, she was a supporting character in the Superman books from Superman 275 in May of 74 to Action Comics 559 in September of 84. So she was around for a decade, but like a lot of the cast built up for the WGBS era of the Clark Kent's day job period in the Superman comics, she has been completely forgotten since 1984 by DC Comics. So it was just cool to see one of those characters getting a bit on the Daily Planet insert, as she should have. So now I relinquish the floor to my esteemed co-host.
Yeah, that was actually one of the ads I was thinking about grabbing, obviously, because when I was buying comics off the rack, odd occasions I went to his bookstore to get one. This is obviously, before I had wheels and could go to a comic book store to get everything every month, But this was the stuff that was on the rack when I was buying the dollar GI combats, So yeah, again, I've mentioned this in the past. These are the books I was reading on the dock up at Lake George back in the day, the Sam Glanzman Haunted Tanks and the OSS stories and everything else. These dollar GI combat books are part of my freaking childhood. I love them all. But yeah, I think that is issue 201 that they're showing there. I'm going to have to go, like you said, go pull it out of the box and flip through it and just relive the old glory days here. So anyway, for my ad, you knew it was only a matter of time before this one got selected by one of us. No, probably me. 100-piece toy soldier set made of durable plastic, each with its own base, $1.50, packed in this pasteboard. Footlocker toy storage box. Each footlocker contains 4 tanks, 4 jeeps, 4 battleships, 4 cruisers, 4 sailors, 4 riflemen, 8 machine gunners, 8 sharpshooters, 4 infantrymen, 8 officers, 8 waves, 8 whacks, 4 bombers, 4 trucks, 8 jet planes, 8 cannon, 4 bazooka men, and 4 marksmen. Imaginary battle scene shown. Lucky Products Incorporated, Box 4536, Westbury, Long Island, New York, 11590, no COD. Rushdie toy soldier set to me. If not satisfied, I may return merchandise for a full refund. And we've all seen this one. It's a drawn ad with a cliff side full of green army men firing rifles, bazookas, artillery pieces, machine guns, etc. at an enemy fleet. Overhead are several jets swooping in on a tech run on the fleet. There's a footlocker-esque of the cliff that you store all these toys in. And quick note, there are 2 waves or whacks or someone standing at attention in the middle of this battle being saluted by presumably an officer. Get down. Sheesh. But I bet you were like me when you see this ad and you envision that these toy soldiers are the size of the standard Toy Story Green Army men. You would be wrong. The ad doesn't tell you that they are flat, 2-dimensional figurines, which figures because that footlocker is only the size of a small shoebox, 6.5 by 3.5 by 2 3/8 or something like that. They were made in Hong Kong, of course. The disappointment so many kids must have had getting these is palpable even today. Based on some follow-up articles I read, these were not meant to be taken outside since they were obviously more brittle, but were pretty good for displaying in dioramas. These are collectible today if you could find them. These days, these might be actually pretty cool to own for old farts like us.
Well, I got to jump in and tell you that that may be, but I threw mine out. Yes, people, this was one of the few things I sent away for when we saw the ad in the comic book because my dad thought they would be cool. Yeah, my dear old dad. But it's also one of the few times we completely and totally agreed about something, because when this thing showed up, we were like, this is the cheapest piece of crap I've ever seen, and I'm very angry about this. Like, I was a little kid, and he was a grown man, and he was excited to get them. He thought, oh, this is going to be cool, and he opened them up. First, you see the box, and you already know this ain't going to be all that great. And you open it up, and it just sucks. And so we threw them out that day. That day, we played taps for the little and this is the ad that since I ordered the stuff and it sucked, this broke my faith in anything advertised in the comics from that early in my childhood. No matter what I saw an ad for, I'm like, yeah, it looks cool. Fun ad. It's probably a piece of crap, though. So comics in this way broke me of my optimism early in life. So just wanted to say that I did actually get these things. And yeah, they are real bad. So bad. You could go to the grocery store or the drugstore and get a bag of the Good Army Men for cheaper than this and have your there's shoe boxes kicking around the house. Paint one of those or whatever. You know, so
I'll end my rant. There'll be photos in the album for this episode because I went looking for these things. Obviously, I turned it into one of those dive into the ad, you know, episodes and stuff. So there'll be pictures in the album so you'll see what these things actually looked like. So.
Yeah, because there's no photo of mine. So we weren't going to waste film on those things back then. So that's it for the spotlighted ads. Rich is going to lead us off into our section called Gods. Any last words?
Conagher plus Redondo will usually equal winning in my book. But honestly, there were no dogs in this entire issue. Well, okay, never mind. You know what I mean. Good ads, letters, and cover. We have a complete package here, top half of the pile for sure, even with my hordes of hell nitpicks.
Yeah, we flip-flopped on the first and last stories as that opener left me cold, and Hordes was both visually and mostly conceptually entertaining for me. For the second time in a row, Canterbury takes the crown in my kingdom, but on my side of the podcast here, Hordes of Hell was a close second. So yeah, to have all this stuff that I enjoyed that much in this tight a race, positive take on this issue. So that's that, people. We have wrapped the issue. We've done the last words. We're going to hit the scuttlebutt here. And this is our odds and ends section of the show. And I mentioned that we have an awesome Facebook page, as Rich mentioned earlier, run mostly by Rich. I show up now and then and that ruin things. But an incredible Facebook page, Weird Warriors Podcast. Look it up. Send us messages there, interact. It's people that add more energy to the show than I do over there. By far, we've got some great listeners and just a cool community over there that Rich has built from the ground up. And if you want to support that community, you can go over to redbubble.com and search for the Weird Warriors Podcast and order some merch. And if you take a picture of yourself with that merch or just a picture of your hand holding it, something, and send it in a message to that awesome Facebook page, Rich will send you something called a Sam Star. Now, for those who haven't heard about it before, Rich, what is that?
No, come on. You ought to know it by now. We've been talking about it every damn episode. 1, 2, 3. Sam Klansman runs flag up outside house. Stays there for 5 years. Falls to pieces. I take it down for Sue. She gives it to me. I keep it. I cut out stars and give those stars to fans of the show that buy merch. It's a special little piece of comics history because, like I said, Sam himself, comics great Sam Glansman himself, ran that flag outside of his home where he did so much of his career, his art, his routine. I've been there. Max has been there. We've been in the room where it happens, okay? So having the opportunity to own something that Sam held and ran up outside of his house, it's an opportunity, folks. You should take an opportunity of it too. And who did this? Why, we have photographic proof that friend of the show, David Steele, has purchased a Weird Warriors Podcast t-shirt. That makes 3 non-cast members that have ordered something. A Sam Star is en route. You should certainly have it, even in the UK, by the time you hear this episode. Please let me know if you haven't. Thank you for your support, sir. Who's next?
Yeah, I mean, that's a decent percentage of the Sam Stars that have gone out overseas, okay? The American side is being left behind by our overseas allies. Very, very soon, they'll have passed you by. So get moving, all right? So that's it for the scuttlebutt, but we're not done yet. Rich, being the giving soul that he is, and the reason this show continues on in the excellent form that it does, and being my polar opposite in that giving soul department, has something for you. He has a little teaser for the next episode.
Weird War Tales 53. Stray Rounds. Treasure Hunts. Another Bob Wiechek signed Day After Doomsday. A tag team tale? We say hi and bye-bye to so many creators, you'll need a score sheet. And speaking of which, do you like Batman? Of course you do. A legendary Batman artist signs up for a hitch, too. Who is it? Come on back in 2 weeks for the unveiling. And vote for your favorite Intel report.
Yeah, and we've already had one legendary Batman artist in this very issue. Marshall Rogers just left. So it's another legendary Batman artist coming. All right. And I'll just spoil it and say, no, it's not Todd McFarlane. All right. He was a child, people. Okay. So that's it. That's it for this. And, you know, we'll be there to find out who this legendary Batman artist is alongside you. And who are we? We're the Weird Warriors. We're the Batland Bros. This is the Weird Warriors podcast where we promise to make war.
Oh. War.